I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Now, Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. Here's your host, KMOX Health Editor, Fred Bottomer.
Hi there, and thanks for joining me for today's show. I really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. Coming up on Health Matters, we'll talk about the need for getting a flu shot and some upcoming free flu vaccine clinics. We'll also discuss complicated grief and COVID-19 and how that's on the rise. And we'll find out about a big honor for SSM Health St. Mary's Hospital. But first, let's start the show the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Fred.
Lots to discuss regarding coronavirus and the president and the White House, but wanted to start with you about some things that Missouri Governor Mike Parsons said at the end of the week regarding a mask mandate or a vaccine mandate.
If you want to talk about mask mandates by the governor or one individual person, let me tell you why I believe that you have to be very careful as governor when you do things like that. There's a vaccine that'll be out in 2 or 3 months, probably. So do we want one person in the state to be able to tell every man, woman, and child that they're going to have a vaccine? That's the road we're going down. That's why it's important for me, for the mayors, the county executives, the county commissioners, to get the public input to see what their districts want to do. I don't ever want to be able to be in a situation where I could use the power of the governor to do things like that. I recommend wearing a mask from day one, continue to do that, but I'm confident the leaders in this state can make the right decisions for their people.
Dr. Buchholz, I imagine you have some comment on that.
Yeah, much. I think a couple things with this. One is just acknowledging the fact that our own knowledge about masks in particular has evolved as we've dealt with COVID. And again, to be completely candid and fair, I think there was some skepticism about the impact of masks, particularly early on, that even the medical community shared. So I understand that it's a bridge to cross for all of us. On the flip side, we now know that clearly mask wearing has a benefit in reducing spread. And there's a difference, I think, with any intervention about policy versus a request. And that's really just based on human psychology. It's just when there's a mandate, it tends to get done on a bit broader scale than if it's done just at people's own volition. And the same is true when you look at smoking cessation and the impact of smoking on public health. Even going back to, the tap water we all drink has fluoride in it. It's not because fluoride makes the water better tasting or anything. It's because it's a public health mandate that's been around since the 50s. These all have huge impacts, and the medical community is pretty firm in the sense that if people wore masks on a larger scale, the spread of this would certainly be reduced. And I think the only way to really impact that is for some degree of mandating masks. New York City was the epicenter, and frankly, coronavirus is out of control in New York City for a short amount of time. It was really until the implementation of policies, particularly face masks, that has allowed that city, which is the most populous city in the country by far, to kind of start getting back to a little bit of normalcy, not to where it was before COVID, but certainly more and more businesses are opening up. And, I think that sets, at least shows the impact of this. And I just disagree. I think it's the government's job in a time of a mass emergency that we have to kind of organize ourselves to push things that are going to save people's lives. We've already had 200,000 people die This is something that's simple. It has very minimal downside and very large upside. And these are the type of public health things that are just a win. And it's just a no-brainer at this point. Going to the vaccines, I understand the point. And again, I think there's a lot of questions about what the vaccines are going to do. We still have yet to have a proven vaccine. And the difference between mandating vaccines and mandating face masks, in my mind, are two wholly different things because we don't know the risk-benefit analysis well of the vaccine yet. But that being said about vaccines, I mean, to go to school, generally a kid has to have their vaccines up to date. One of those vaccines includes something like polio, which up until the 1950s was a deadly, deadly disease that every parent was terrified of. I have a father of four kids. I don't even think about polio. It's not even in my brain. It's not because I don't know what polio is. It's because it's not an issue in the United States anymore. That's the power of a good vaccine. So, you know, we've got to be thoughtful about this. And, you know, sometimes it is appropriate for a government to say, you can't do this. You can't say fire in a public theater for a very clear, important public safety reason. Masks are a good thing for a very clear, important public safety reason. It's that simple.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, let's switch ground a little bit and talk about President Trump and the treatments he's received since he was found positive with coronavirus. He's had three major treatments, remdesivir, Regeneron monoclonal antibodies, and dexamethasone. Talk to us about each one of those. What do they involve? Who gets them, and what are the risks?
Sure. So I'm going to skip the orders a little bit. I'm going to go I'm going to start with dexamethasone. So we've chatted about this before, Fred, and basically dexamethasone has been used in the treatment of COVID, really, I think, since about June, based on a large trial out of the United Kingdom called the Recovery Trial that used dexamethasone in what we would call hospitalized patients. So if you're admitted to the hospital for COVID, they gave you dexamethasone and saw if it improved mortality. Basically, did people die in the hospital or not after 30 days from the onset of symptoms? And what we found is the general answer is yes. Kind of a deeper analysis showed that people that were on oxygen or in the ICU kind of received a bigger benefit or got more bang for their buck taking dexamethasone than those that didn't. The key thing here is hospitalized patients. And again, the president was admitted to Walter Reed, although, you know, whether or not it was truly a hospitalized situation is I think, you know, depends on your perspective. But, you know, in this sense, him getting dexamethasone is generally, in my mind, fairly appropriate if you just go by the strict criteria. Side effects of dexamethasone, it's a drug that's been around for a long time. It's a steroid. Steroids can give you quite a bit of euphoria. It's pretty interesting what it can do. I always tell a story when I was an intern. So this was just say a couple years ago, but I was a first year doctor and I'm on call at night and this lady was admitted, 83-year-old lady, you know, maybe 90 pounds, maybe, was admitted for a COPD exacerbation, was on high dose steroids. And I get called up to her room. She's dressed in her Sunday dress, ready to go to church at 2 o'clock in the morning and insisted on leaving. And this 83-year-old just all of a sudden just sprinted down the hallway to the stairwell. When I finally caught up to her, she turned around and punched me in the chest. And it was a hard punch. You know, so this frail 83-year-old all of a sudden becomes a superstar that a 20-something-year-old person couldn't catch up with right away. So, I mean, that's what steroids do. It's pretty impactful. You know, those effects wane fairly quickly, but they can really have a huge effect in terms of how people think and kind of make decisions. So that's the biggest effect with steroids. The second drug is remdesivir. And again, we've talked about this quite a bit too. My own institution was a participant in trials dealing with remdesivir. And what remdesivir does is basically shorten the duration of hospitalization for people hospitalized from COVID by about 4 days. There's a hint or there's maybe a thought that might improve mortality, but that has not been proven. Remdesivir is an IV medicine, so you have to get it in a hospital setting. The big side effect from that is renal failure. So, that's something we have to watch very, very closely. We can't give it to you if you have liver abnormalities, so we have to kind of watch very carefully. But, you know, it does have an effect in terms of reducing length of stay in the hospital. The last is this monoclonal antibody from Regeneron, and that that essentially is kind of the same or refined product from our same strategy as giving people convalescent plasma. So the idea with convalescent plasma is you take blood essentially from people that have had COVID, and you're hoping that the antibodies in that blood, when you give it to a different patient and now is affected with COVID, will improve their symptoms and get them better faster. Whenever you give blood to somebody, there are quite a bit of possible reactions. With plasma, it's a little less so, but they can have a lot of immune reactions and a lot of side effects from the plasma. So the idea of giving these monoclonal antibodies is just basically taking a couple of the antibodies from blood and then just putting that in a product and then giving that to patients. So with this, the data that's out there says that this monoclonal product reduces viral counts, so it reduces the amount of virus that's in the body for people that have COVID, and it reduces the symptoms compared to not getting it. The caveat that is, and I think the thing that puzzles me about it is, there's not what we call a dose-response relationship. So if you think about it with like any kind of drug, the idea is basically the more drug you give, the more impact it ought to have. With Regeneron, what's kind of confusing is like the lower dose actually had more of an effect in the studies that they've released compared to the higher dose, which is what the president got. And so it depends what your interpretation, your degree of cynicism is or skepticism is in reading that study, but that doesn't make a lot of intuitive sense. And it just, in my mind, when I see that, I always have a little bit of an antenna that there may be some errors in the study or the statistics are, this may all be due to random chance. But the bigger trials are going on now, but this was definitely an experimental drug, and the side effects really are unknown yet. The company says it's safe, but that's usually what happens. And then 3 years later, you find out that there's issues that are more available, are prevalent when you see it done on a massive scale. So with all these antibody tests or treatments, we don't know if they have an effect or not. Same thing with convalescent plasma. And again, I've used it. You know, it's not to say that I'm not opposed to giving it. It would be the one I'm least aggressive in giving to a patient with COVID right now.
Dr. Buchholz, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure, Fred. Thank you.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health, St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up on Health Matters, we'll talk about the upcoming influenza season and the need to get that flu shot. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Lots of flu shots being offered all across the area now. And this weekend and continuing next weekend, SSM Health is offering some free flu vaccine clinics. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Barry Clavine. Dr. Clavine is an emergency medicine physician at SSM Health DePaul Hospital. Dr. Clavine, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Wanted to talk to you about flu shots and some free flu shot clinics that are coming up thanks to SSM Health. But first, wanted to talk to you in general about influenza and the flu shots. How important is it this year to get a flu shot?
I think it's as important this year as it is any year. The flu is a major health hazard and can make people not only sick but also kill them. Certainly with the presence of COVID in our community, being as healthy as possible is going to make you more able to fight that infection in addition to the flu. Again, it's as important as it ever is, and if not more important this year.
Do you fear a possible twindemic?
It wouldn't be great if it happened. Do I fear it? Absolutely. I fear this COVID epidemic. It's not been going our way lately. It's only going to get worse with the flu coming around. So yes, absolutely. I fear that possibility. But again, I hope for the best.
What are the symptoms for the flu, and how do they differ from the symptoms for COVID-19?
They would be remarkably similar. Headache, fevers, myalgias or achy muscles, nausea and vomiting, diarrhea is sometimes seen. Those are very similar to the symptoms that we'll see with COVID. Most people don't complain of loss of the sense of smell or taste, as many COVID patients have, but the general symptoms are very, very similar and in many cases overlap almost, exactly.
Can you get both the flu and COVID-19 at the same time?
Absolutely. There's no reason why you couldn't. There are several influenza viruses, and you can get both of those at the same time, both influenza A and influenza B. I've seen people infected with both simultaneously. You could also get the coronavirus with influenza at the same time. Yes, absolutely.
Dr. Clavin, who should get the flu vaccine?
Everyone who's of the appropriate age and health status, everyone 6 months of age or older, and without any of the contraindications, if you are actively ill with an infection, if you have influenza actively, if you have COVID actively, or if you're under investigation, you wouldn't want to get a flu shot at that point in time until you're feeling better. People with life-threatening allergies to flu shots would not want to get it, but everyone 6 months of age or older without those contraindications should get a flu shot.
Dispel some of the myths about the flu shot. People that say, oh, I got the flu shot, it gave me the flu, I'll never get another flu shot.
Yeah, you cannot get the flu from a flu shot. The flu shot itself, the immunization, is an inactivated form of the virus. It does not contain any live virus particles. You cannot contract the flu from a flu shot. There is a nasal spray form of the immunization that is a live attenuated version that is designed to only replicate in the nose, the mucosa surfaces of the nose. It will not cause lower respiratory symptoms and will not cause influenza. There is no way that you can get an active influenza virus from a shot. The shot itself can make you feel a bit achy. It can make you feel sore at the site of the immunization. You can get headaches and sometimes some nausea, but those symptoms are certainly much less severe than the actual flu itself. Anyone who gets the flu after they get a flu shot was going to get the flu anyway. It takes about 2 weeks for the flu shot to be effective in preventing the flu.
When is the right time to get a flu shot?
As early as you can. Yeah, every year you need to get a flu shot, and ideally before the flu is circulating in the community. So now would be a great time to go ahead and get that shot.
And the vaccine will carry through all the way to the end of the flu season, even if it is in late April?
Through this season, yeah. It'll be protective at least until then.
We're talking with Dr. Barry Clavin. Dr. Clavin is an emergency medicine physician at SSM Health DePaul Hospital about the flu shot. Dr. Clavin, in the Southern Hemisphere this year, they've already had their flu season, and there was relatively non-existent, and they're giving a lot of credit to all the prevention practices that people there were doing to keep them safe from COVID-19. You think we're going to see anything similar here in the St. Louis area or in the United States?
If we're looking at those countries that have very low COVID numbers in general, New Zealand comes to mind. If their flu season was mild because of the prevention steps that they took, I do not think that the United States shares the same level of success in preventing COVID. And so I would similarly think that we would not have the same success in preventing an influenza epidemic. I would hope that the distancing and the masks that we're wearing, we would start to be more careful as we are moving indoors. But if the past is any predictor of the future, the United States has lagged behind some of our other counterparts in the Southern Hemisphere as far as success in preventing the spread of this virus, and I don't know why the influenza virus would be any different.
Will a flu shot protect us in any way from possibly getting COVID-19?
No. The influenza shot does not protect against COVID. They're two different viruses. We do not yet have an effective vaccine against the COVID-19, the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID-19.
And if you've already had COVID-19, might that give you any protection from influenza?
Having had COVID-19 will not protect you from getting influenza, no.
Tell us about the upcoming free flu vaccine clinics that SSM Health is sponsoring.
Yeah, on Saturday, October 17th from 8 a.m. to noon, anyone aged 9 years and above can come to any of four locations for a free flu shot while supplies are available. There'll be a clinic at Ronnie's Plaza in St. Louis, at DePaul Hospital, at St. Joseph Hospital in St. Charles, and at St. Joseph Hospital in Lake St. Louis. All four of those locations will be having that immunization clinic October 17th from 8 till noon. First come, first serve. It's a drive-through clinic only and injectable vaccines only. They won't have the nasal immunization available.
Good deal. Anything else you want to bring up, Doctor?
No, I think we've covered everything. It's very important, like I said, that everyone get the flu vaccine this year and every year. I hope that becomes more widespread. It's going to help us out a lot.
Dr. Clavin, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
Happy to help.
Emergency medicine physician Dr. Barry Clavin at SSM Health DePaul Hospital. Coming up on Health Matters, we'll talk about complicated grief and how it's on the rise during the pandemic. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. The coronavirus pandemic has led to what some are calling a grief tsunami. Every COVID-19 death in the United States results in about 9 survivors who have lost a grandparent, a parent, a sibling, a spouse, or a child. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Alka Kapoor. Dr. Kapoor is a senior services physician with the SSM Health Medical Group. Dr. Kapoor, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Fred.
What are you dealing with these days when it comes to families grieving the loss of loved ones?
So, as you rightly said, these are very challenging times. And one of the things which is really, really striking to us is the fact that a lot of our patients are dying alone, either in the hospital or in the skilled nursing facilities. And those patients who are dying at home are, of course, being cared for by their family members, but they do not have the support of their extended family, their neighbors, their friends, just because of the fact of the social isolation aspect. Also because families are not allowing very many visitors just because of fear of coronavirus spread. So the fact of the matter is that people are dying alone. So the family members who are actually left behind are really, really at risk for what we call as complicated grief. So we know that when we lose a loved one, it's very natural to experience normal grief and bereavement, which is basically for, you know, a period of time where there are feelings of loss and sorrow and numbness, and these feelings gradually ease with time. With complicated grief, these feelings of loss are very debilitating, and they do not improve as time passes. And unfortunately, this can lead to some long-term health implications, including depression, including more health issues for the family members who are surviving, and, you know, more mental health challenges. What we are realizing as time is going on, that we have, as physicians, have to learn to be proactive about predicting that.
And how do you do that, Dr. Kapoor?
We are trying to make these families aware of what may be coming down the road. So increasing awareness of the possibility that their grief could be different from what usual grief is. Also trying to give them some information as to what they could do to prevent that from happening, which could be, you know, just talking to family members, talking to friends, talking to each other, you know, having Zoom meetings instead of in-person meetings, we realize that they are not able to give the family's members funerals of their choice or what the family members had wished for, and that is sometimes a source of a lot of guilt for these family members. Just trying to be aware that such a thing is known to happen, is likely to happen, and telling them it's possible that you, what you may feel may be different from what you have felt in a situation in the past, and why this is different, and why what they can do to take care of themselves when they should ask for help.
We're talking with Dr. Alka Kapoor. Dr. Kapoor is a senior services physician with SSM Health Medical Group. How important is it to allow yourself to grieve or mourn after the loss of a loved one?
I think that's a very important part of healthy grieving or healthy bereavement. And it is important to, first of all, realize what has happened. Also realize that these are unusual circumstances. And also realize that if we do not follow through on giving ourselves permission to grieve appropriately, then it could implicate our health down the road. So you're right. Yes, we certainly need to give ourselves permission to grieve, take care of ourselves. There should not be no feeling of guilt associated with it because a lot of families say, well, we wish we could have done something else. And that is very true. But unfortunately, nothing we can do can prepare us for the situation we are dealing with at this time.
Dr. Kapoor, how do you define complicated grief, and what are the warning signs?
Normal grief is, like I said, a period of sorrow, numbness, even guilt or anger, which people experience. This is very distressing. Usually these feelings ease, and it is possible to accept the loss and move forward. That's normal bereavement. On the contrary, these feelings of loss, if they become debilitating and do not improve after time passes, that is called complicated grief. So painful emotions can be so long-lasting and severe that family members may have trouble recovering from the loss and resuming their own life. So that is basically, in a nutshell, what complicated grief is.
And how is it treated? Is it therapy? Is it medicine? What do you do?
So, the first thing is, I think if there is any way to prepare folks for what may be coming. So, you know, there are risk factors. For example, generally, if we have people who have mental health issues previously, they could be more prone to have complicated grief. If it's a death of a child, if there's a close or dependent relationship to the deceased, lack of social support, if there are major life stressors like major financial hardships. So these are some situations which can make a person more prone. So the first thing is being able to assess that risk. And in our hospice patients, a risk assessment is done for grief or complicated grief as a routine on every patient who is admitted to our program. So that is the first step where we can identify. Now, what we can do about it, yes, we can prevent it by increasing the awareness. But what we can do about it is support from family members. Bereavement counseling is a huge part. And then if we realize that we may have symptoms of depression or suicidal thoughts, anxiety, including PTSD, sleep disturbances, then we encourage the family members to seek medical help from their physicians.
Dr. Kapoor, thanks so much for your time.
You're very welcome, Fred.
Dr. Alka Kapoor is a senior services physician with the SSM Health Medical Group. Coming up on Health Matters, we'll talk about a big honor for SSM Health St. Mary's Hospital. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. SSM Health St. Mary's Hospital has been named a 2020 Best Maternity Hospital by Newsweek magazine, the only hospital in the St. Louis region to receive this honor. Here to talk with us about that is Pam Lesser. Pam is Director of Perinatal Services at SSM Health St. Mary's. Pam, thanks for joining us.
Hey, happy to be here.
So tell us about this big honor.
So we were very excited to be notified that we had received this recognition about our work that we've been passionate about, working on quality and safety for our moms and our babies and the outcomes that we have. And so when Newsweek notified us that we were among one of the top 250 hospitals in the nation to receive this award, we obviously were very proud of what we've done, but also, and even more so, very, very proud and happy for the work we've done to try to keep our moms and our babies safe.
So let's talk about some of the things offered at St. Mary's Hospital. It's been designated a high-risk pregnancy center. What is that?
So as a high-risk center, what it means is that we have a group of specialists who are physicians who have additional training beyond being an obstetrician to be a maternal fetal medicine specialist, sometimes called a perinatologist. That means that they're training additional 3 years beyond normal OB training. Focuses on high-risk conditions that occur in pregnancy, as well as looking at the baby inside the mom and evaluating what risks might be happening to the baby as it forms and develops in the uterus. So we have this great physician team through St. Louis University that we partner with, but we also have a group of nurses here that are trained and focused in really caring from the continuum of caring for a mom who comes in wanting the most low intervention, low technology birth, but also to be able to care for some really high risk conditions that might include having a mom have to stay in the hospital for weeks to months due to a maternal condition, or in those unforeseen circumstances where a mom might end up in an intensive care unit because of some other medical condition, that our collaboration with all of our members here at the hospital can take care of all of that.
St. Mary's also has a level 3 neonatal ICU. Tell us about that, and how critical is it?
One of the goals in caring for a high-risk baby is that babies do best when they get to the high-risk facility in the original container. And that original container is the mom and still keeping the baby in the uterus. So we know that we get better baby outcomes when we can get a mom to our high-risk facility and have the baby be born here and handed off immediately to our neonatology colleagues that we partner with, Cardinal Glennon Hospital. And so we can take care of those very high-risk babies most of the time here without needing to be transferred to Cardinal Glennon. And you see better outcomes when those babies are transferred in that way. Obviously, we've got great supports that can go out to the community and pick up high-risk babies from any place and take them to Cardinal Glennon. But we know that the outcomes are better when we can get the mom here first. And so part of what we offer here at St. Mary's is that we have a maternal transport team that can partner with community hospitals around Southern Illinois and through Southern Central Missouri to go pick up high-risk moms and bring them back to us if necessary.
Pam, tell us about some of the safety initiatives that you think might have been helpful in getting this honor from Newsweek magazine.
Yeah, I thank you for asking that question. I think some of the things that we have been working on here is really to try to reduce those first-time cesarean section rates. We know that moms are at greater risk if they've had a cesarean delivery, and for that pregnancy as well as ones following. cesareans are absolutely appropriate some of the time, but we know in this country they're probably done more often than needed. And so one of the points of our recognition is that we have a very low rate of C-section rates for first-time moms, and it's preventing that first one that is really the most critical. We also have a team that works very vigorously to be sure that we don't do inductions of labor earlier than is indicated. So not doing an induction before 39 weeks, and actually many times see pregnancies go to 40 or 41 weeks even. We have a very low rate of episiotomies, which I think is something that most moms appreciate if that was not medically needed. But we also have some really intense programs about obstetrical hemorrhage and high blood pressure and initiatives to keep moms safe from some of those things that are the most some of the biggest causes of maternal illness and severe outcomes in pregnancy. And so the programs that we do with education of our staff and drills and simulations and really looking at every case when it happens to be sure that we can learn from it and get the best outcome for every mom and baby.
We're talking with Pam Lesser. Pam is the director of perinatal services at SSM Health St. Mary's Hospital. Pam, let's talk about coronavirus. What impact has coronavirus and COVID-19 had on what you do there at St. Mary's?
Yeah, boys, coronavirus kind of threw us all for a loop, just like everybody else in the country. And so we, as a team, really had to learn a lot very quickly and figure out how to still provide the best birth experience for a mom, baby, family, and still keep everybody safe in an environment when we were just learning the rules and learning what was unique about this virus. Our focus always was to keep asking that question about what's best for the mom and the baby. And so, you know, while hospitals around the country sort of shut down visiting hours and really tried to keep other family members out, from the beginning, we knew it was really critical that mom have at least one support person with her when she came in to have a baby. So that was always one of our standards. We really looked at what was safe if a mom came in that was positive for the virus, and how to care for that mom and that baby and still really hold intact the bonding between them, the family unit, knowing that breastfeeding was still most important for that baby if we could do that. And so I think as our team of physicians and nurses, OB, neonatology worked together, we really had some plans that did the best. But we know that the families are walking into an environment they didn't bargain for when they were having this joyful birth of their new family member. So we still keep pushing ourselves to say, how can we provide the best experience, listen to what the families want and need, and still keep it safe?
Pam, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
All right. You are very welcome.
Pam Lesser is the director of perinatal services at SSM Health St. Mary's Hospital. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If there are parts of this show you want to hear again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. Or you can download the Radio.com app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week at the same time for another edition of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.